Hello and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations for 2022, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. My guest today is Regan Ralph, the founding president and CEO of the Fund for Global Human Rights. Prior to launching the fund, Regan was vice president for health and reproductive rights at the National Women's League's Law Center in Washington, D.C., where she led advocacy, policy, and educational strategies to promote the quality and availability of healthcare for American women. From 1992 to 2001, she helped build and direct the Women's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch, where she developed campaigns to ensure the prosecution of sexual violence in conflict as a war crime, to secure recognition of gender-based persecution as grounds for asylum, and to promote women's rights in countries including Russia, Egypt, Turkey, South Africa, Pakistan, and Mexico. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So I want to start off with a kind of macro question about the state of the world and the state of the human rights movement and efforts to defend and protect human rights. Because my assumption is you've done this your whole life. You've set up the fund in order to accelerate support to organizations doing cutting edge work. And you probably are in a very small group of people who have a deep analysis of what should and shouldn't be done to promote and protect human rights from a perspective of defending both activists, advocates, and organizations. So give me a sense of where you think we are in 2022 from a kind of global human rights audit perspective.
Small questions, huh, Paul? Okay, so I think about this a lot, actually, because a part of what I'm trying to do always is ascertain where human rights are, where human rights are going, and how, with our funding, we can facilitate that work. But to get there, you have to sort of look backwards a little bit and think about where human rights have come. So I would say that, you know, for the past 20 to 30 years, a lot of human rights activism has focused on developing the human rights infrastructure at the international level, to the extent possible, creating some accountability mechanisms, supporting where possible national efforts in that regard, and really articulating and consolidating support for certain international norms in support of human rights protections, all of which is invaluable work. But all of which relied on, in large part, convincing governments, members of the so-called international community, to buy into that project. And a part of how they got them to buy into that project was by saying, if you don't do that, we're going to embarrass you because we will show what a problem you are for human rights. And that's a terrible thing. Everybody can agree and nobody wants to look bad in that way. So that's a methodology that came to be known as naming and shaming. And, you know, then we entered the era over the, let's say, the course of the past 10 to 15 years of the rise of authoritarianism globally. And what the rise of authoritarianism has meant for the human rights business is that it's really hard to develop to deploy a naming and shaming strategy when there are a lot of people running countries who have no shame. And so what do you do in that situation? Now, the good news is we don't have to invent a new set of actors or methodologies or even the next wave of what human rights activism looks like, because over the course of the past 20 to 30 years, while that work was happening at the international level, local level organizations and activists were starting to say, hey, this human rights idea, that's a really politically powerful idea. The idea that all of us have inherent dignity and deserve access to justice and should not have to live with profound inequality. This is a framework that I can get behind, and I'm going to use it to change the fortunes of my community, my family, whatever. And so that's beginning to happen at the same time that the geopolitical context is getting gloomier and gloomier for human rights. So we're at this weird juncture. I like to misquote Dickens and say that, you know, it was the worst of times, in the sense that, unlike what we thought when we started the fund 20 years ago, that we were sort of swinging in the direction of liberal democracy and you know, those values, the clash of values has kind of worked out in favor of democracy and freedom and justice and all of those things. Instead, we're in a situation where it seems like, nope, that's not where the world is trending. The world is trending towards autocracy, repression of minorities, rollbacks on women's rights. I mean, you name it. There are negative indicators globally for the state of human rights. And at the same time, there is this amazing burgeoning of human rights activism happening in countries all over the world. And even in places that are experiencing rollbacks, local organizations are figuring out a way to improve the fortunes of their communities. So when you ask me how would I characterize the global context, I would say in some ways we are grappling now with the swing of the pendulum back from, hey, human rights are great, let's support the project, let's be supportive at least in word of the work that human rights organizations are doing, to wait a minute, they're trying to take our power away. They're trying to put a curb on our power. We're not interested in that, and therefore we're going to make it really difficult for them to do what they want to do. So that's the bad news. The good news is human rights actors are actually better at the local level, are better prepared for that than they ever have been. The dynamics at the global level are hard. There's no question about it. But the question is, what role is the grassroots level going to play moving forward?
Okay, so you mentioned a rise of authoritarianism, and I think we all lulled ourselves into sleep at one moment that we would get a unipolar world and human rights and liberal democracies and constitutionalism would triumph. We now know that we're wrong. And the two big authoritarians with geopolitical power and influence are obviously Russia and China, a range of other actors as well, and not just confined to them. You could argue that, you know, United States has had a deeply authoritarian president in its recent past, and we should fess up to that and confront that and be open to it, because if you don't, human rights actors in the global south think you're a hypocrite and
absolutely,
and a cyclops. But let's focus for a moment on China, just because it's such an economic colossus and so powerful. We've recently, you know, had a People's Tribunal make a ruling that what's happening within it is a genocide against the Uyghur population. So you've got, you know, the world's second most powerful country involved in an internal genocide and deeply authoritarian. But yet the space for local actors to contest that, I should imagine, is tiny. So your theory about local organizations being a propitious area of activism, how does that square with the fact that they have precious little space to be able to organize?
No, I mean, you're right. China is a particularly complicated situation because of the control of the government, because of the government's lack of sense of accountability to either internal actors or external actors, as is evidenced by the genocide against the Uyghurs. I think that there's no short-term solution. I don't think that's what we should be looking for. And when I think about the value of civil society, in any context, it is to provide a counterbalance to the kind of abuses that you're talking about. And obviously, in a country like China, civil society hasn't been allowed to develop in the way that it has in other parts of the world. It exists, but it's, you know, it is very tightly constrained. So I think that in some ways, the best that we can do is take a pretty long view here and think about, how do we shore up those elements of civil society that are there right now? It doesn't mean an immediate end to the acute human rights problems that you're talking about. But I do think that one thing that has been definitely true in my career is that, you know, this idea of universal human rights has been challenged for all kinds of reasons in all kinds of ways. And I was a women's rights activist for many years, and I was told, you know, you're trying to impose a Western standard of feminism on our societies. And it was very easy to rebut those arguments because I was working collaboratively with women from all over the world who said, who gets to decide my dignity, what my dignity looks like besides me? And so I do think that there is the movement that has happened in defense of universal human rights is because that's a real thing. People everywhere want dignity. They want control over their lives. They want access to justice when they're denied things. And they will figure out a way to start making work on it, regardless of the circumstances they're in. I mean, it's astonishing, actually, what the kinds of risks that human rights activists take. So I'm not trying to put a gloss on the situation in China. I know it's bad, and I know that the possibilities of immediate change are small. But I do think that the idea that you can do this over time and invest in the development of civil society, whatever it looks like, understanding that you might not fund, you know, those human rights organizations that are denouncing the regime as your starting point, but you might be funding local organizations to improve their communities in some ways, engage in small P politics in some ways, things that make them feel ownership and like the sense of possibility of their future. And that's what I've seen over in countries over and over again. Obviously, not perhaps as stark a contrast as is the case in China, but that sense of possibility creates movement over time, and it's sometimes really impossible to know what's going to happen. I mean, I can give an example. It's not the same kind of global behemoth, but you know, the Fund for Global Human Rights, my organization, started supporting civil society work in Tunisia in 2004 when there were maybe five independent human rights organizations in the country. The government, it was a police state. The government controlled civil society, except for these five organizations, entirely. And it was just the most bizarre place to be, because you had all of these incredibly sophisticated activists who couldn't have an honest conversation unless they went and had a cigarette in the garden, right? And we started funding there, and people would say to us, why are you doing that? Nothing's going to change. The dictator has a total stranglehold on the society and all aspects of the government. Nothing's ever going to change, especially not with these five tiny little organizations. Well, lo and behold, Tunisia was the birthplace of the Arab revolutions. We can talk about that, where that led and why, but it was the birthplace of the Arab revolutions, and those organizations and their leaders and their members were the ones positioned to come in and start the process of change in Tunisia. Now, unfortunately, things are moving not in such a good direction in Tunisia now, but I guess from what I took away from that is that even if you have a little foothold and people are there with some credibility and some expertise, they will figure out a way to expand the moments when they come up and step into them. And I think that's a place to start, at least. I mean, it's why I focus on a localized approach, because I do think that things are possible at a very local level, even when things look so dire at a macro level.
So let's focus for a moment on the intersection between classic human rights work and emerging forms of climate activism, mm-hmm. in part because I think it may give us a clue, I think, but you tell me otherwise, mm-hmm. to how you think about a place like China, where on the one hand, you mentioned the Uyghurs and Chinese Communist Party control or torture or Tibet or Taiwan, you're in dead trouble. But Client Earth can walk into China and train judges to bring and prosecutors to bring climate cases with the active collaboration of the government. Mm-hmm. And my idea, but I'm interested to hear your view, not just in China but elsewhere, is that what that does is it breaks open social space mm-hmm. for forms of activism that even authoritarian governments in some circumstances may have an interest in having a proceed. And then when you do that, what you're doing is you're producing a set of intended or unintended consequences, which is creating the space for the rule of law, for lawyers, for victims to bring claims. And if you can bring it on climate, well, why can't you bring it on when your sister has been raped by a local police officer or a local party official? If it's a local party official, that starts becoming an interesting exercise of power. So do you see climate as potentially being a space to work in from a local level that has intersections with human rights work?
Oh, absolutely. And I see talking about human rights, you have to talk about power, right? And some of the most exciting work that I have seen at the local level has been advocacy by groups and communities that don't accept the existing power balance. And I'll give you an example. We've been funding in Guatemala since 2003. And Guatemala is a country that has rich natural resources. There are Canadian and U.S. companies that come there to mine gold. They've sold, the government has, in usually pretty corrupt deals, sold rights to, you know, penetrate the land to these mining companies, and they sell it as a development strategy, right? Oh, we'll bring these folks in, they bring money, they bring jobs, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's of course not what actually happens. Many of the mining companies use a technique called cyanide leach mining to surface the gold, which destroys the groundwater. It ends the community's ability to live in relationship to their environment. It just, you know, they no longer have access to potable water. They can't make a living anymore. They protest against the mines. The mines don't want to hire them, so there are no jobs. They bring people from outside. And so the local community said, this is unacceptable. We reject this as a development strategy. And all of their well-intentioned colleagues based in, you know, capitals in the north said, you're never going to win against the mining companies. So why don't you just see if you can get them to give you some more money? And the group said, the indigenous rights group said, no, that's not what we're interested in. So they started doing things like protesting. They blocked the entrances to mines. They also took the international, what is it, the ILO, the International Labor Organization standard that these kinds of projects require free, prior, and informed consent from the communities. And even though that wasn't the law of land and the land in Guatemala, they trained the local political leaders in those principles, and they encouraged them to hold referenda, which they did, and community after community rejected these strategies, right? So they weren't denouncing the government. They were challenging, I mean, indirectly. They obviously were challenging something that the government was pursuing quite avidly. But they were going after this practice of destroying the environments in which their communities lived as a way of expressing their ability to control the well-being and protect the rights of their communities. And I think that, I do think that that it creates space in a country that was at that point practically a failed state, and they were actually successful in many instances. So, and you know, similarly, there are other issues, and they might be women's rights, or they might be other things that are not seen as directly politically confronting governments that are only too willing to crack down. But when people get in the habit, it's just as you're suggesting, when people get in the habit of experiencing the rule of law or being involved in decisions that affect their communities or doing something that protects their family, it changes their sense of what's possible.
So we're having this conversation 12 or 13 days into the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Without a doubt, war crimes have been and are being committed. Human Rights Council has fast-tracked an investigation. The ICC is actively seized of it. Reports from the ground indicate that this is happening. But I want to take a step back and ask you a sort of macro question about what it means for human rights and the battle against authoritarianism. Because in some ways, you could argue the West, to the extent that West is synonymous with defending human rights, open parentheses, problematic, close parentheses. but in some ways, people committed to constitutionalism, human rights, and liberalism went to sleep following the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of apartheid, the wave of democracy through Latin America, and just said, we're all going to be on this path. And then all of a sudden, authoritarians crept in, and authoritarians began to chip away at the resolve of the West, and Russia in particular committed horrendous crimes in a whole range of places. And everybody basically said, that's not our beat, that's not our fight. There seems to be an unusual resolve, at least from America and Europe, but also a range of other countries, that this is our fight and this is our moment. And if this wins, it will have severe consequences, not just for the occupation of Ukraine, but geopolitically in the fight for human rights. And therefore, is there not an argument to say at this moment we potentially are in a turning point where liberalism or human rights becomes more muscular, and more muscular in a way that might make us human rights types queasy, but actually might be quite necessary in a world where authoritarian rule is out there. And that's something that we may need to be comfortable with, which is confronting in more direct ways these forms of abuse. And love your thoughts on that.
Well, I definitely believe in confronting directly various forms of abuse, but I'm not sure that I'm going to sign up for the muscular vision for human rights. And let me say what I mean by that, because I think human rights is a very muscular idea myself. I think it's a very politically powerful idea, but I think it's important to remember that different actors have different roles here, right? And we have to be somewhat realistic about what kind of advocate any government, United States, Great Britain, Russia, anybody is going to be for human rights. So I think that, I don't mean to put those all in the same category, but I just think that we have to be realistic about what governments see as their self-interest. And yes, I think there was probably a lot of the liberal, the forces for liberal good sort of thought, like maybe we did, you know, things are trending in a certain direction. We've accomplished something significant and we can take for granted the fact that that trend is going to continue. At the same time, what was not happening when the folks were, or governments were falling asleep at the wheel, was the attention to inequality and that was sort of yawning in places around the world, and the small p political realities of the fact that authoritarians were stepping into people's frustration with that inequality. So that's that's maybe a different conversation. But the to come back to your point about what is really needed in these situations. I may sound like I'm, you know, a broken record, but I really think that if we all lived in countries where civil society was robust and diverse, deep and wide, these conversations would be completely different. We wouldn't be depending on governments outside our country to come in and rescue us when we have a bad political leader. One of the things that I've been thinking about since Russia invaded Ukraine was what people in Ukraine are doing is actually in some ways an incredible example of that. You know, they are taking responsibility for defending their values and their country in a way that is incredibly powerful. And I think maybe the muscularity of the response from Europe and the United States comes from the fact that they're looking at the authoritarian trend over the past however many years and saying, if we don't respond with strength now, the fight is over. And, you know, we can go back to your earlier question about, you know, the power and influence of China as well. So if we're going to make a stand for things that matter to us, let's make a stand now. What the actual tools are for pursuing that stand, you know, I'm not an advocate for anything military in any circumstance. That's not my area of expertise. It's not what I know. What I do know is that if local populations have a history and a tradition of having influence in their countries, their political systems are going to be more responsive. One of the important dynamics, which has of course gotten attention with Russia and Ukraine, is the fact that apparently many Russians didn't even know that Russia had invaded Ukraine. They're just starting to find out now, which is as a consequence of the fact that Putin and his government have systematically ended the independent media, discredited human rights organizations, labeled them foreign agents for taking foreign funding, put them out of business, declared them criminals. And that was a process many years in the making. So if there's a muscularity that I would like to see happen, it's that people who are paying attention to these situations recognize those signs earlier and provide the kind of support that local civil society needs to push back against that kind of repression, because they're still there. They're still fighting the good fight. They're now protesting in the streets of Russia, but they could have used a little solidarity long before we got to this point. And maybe the dynamics in Russia internally would be different if they had.
So I want to pivot now to the work of the fund, because it would just be interesting if we've spoken a bit macro and about context, and I'm clear that funding a local human rights infrastructure and organizations to carry on the fight and being the most reliable protagonists in that fight is a core part of your work. So if you look back over a decade or more and say, where have you made the most interesting investments? I'd like to ask that question first, and then we can pivot to how that strategy might be adjusting and tweaking in the context of 2022. But where have you done the work that you're proudest of, where you've got the best return on your philanthropic investment, you think?
I love that question. And it's in some ways, it's a hard one to answer because we fund local movements in 20 different countries. And the winds come in funny ways and places and are not necessarily, it's not that you can look at the world and say, as a result of the funding that we've done, there's some kind of quantitative metric that has moved forward. But I can definitely tell you some stories that I think are illustrative. I mean, I would say that the work that we did that I described briefly in Guatemala was some of the most exciting work that I've seen happen because it really did invert power dynamics that nobody believed could be inverted. And it was done by organizations that were incredibly marginalized within the country in which they operated. Another example, interestingly, also from Guatemala, comes in the justice realm. And I'm a lawyer by background and training, but I happen to believe that access to justice is kind of a threshold issue. You know, like a functioning justice system and the expectation that you'll get justice when something bad happens is kind of a threshold for actually advancing any kind of respect for human rights. And in this particular instance, there was a civil war in Guatemala for 36 years that finally ended in peace accords in the 1990s. And in the past 10 years or so, groups of indigenous women have brought complaints of sexual violence during the conflict by the Guatemalan military. Now, these women they don't speak Spanish. They didn't go to school, so they have no education. They don't even speak the dominant language of the country. And they were forced into sexual slavery by contingents of the military who had, before they forced them into sexual slavery, killed their husbands, sons, and fathers. So over the course of almost four decades, they pursued cases against the Guatemalan military, the very body that had victimized them, in a nation which did not have a spectacular track record of vindicating human rights. And lawyers pulled to their cause, women's rights activists pulled to their cause. And several years ago, they won the most significant victory in a national court anywhere in the world for crimes against humanity, including sexual violence. That precedent is significant not just in Guatemala, but in the region and in the world. And as evidence of that, just this January, another case worked its way through the Guatemalan court, and the perpetrators were sentenced to the longest sentences possible for crimes against humanity. And when you see that kind of paradigm shift with what justice means for marginalized populations, to me, that's the kind of return on investment that it's huge for the people who are vindicated through the system, but it's also huge for all the people who see that happen. So one of the things that maybe we'll talk about at some point is the importance of taking risks when you are funding human rights work, and something that I'm sorry to say I think too few funders are willing to do. But one of the organizations that we have supported in Uganda for a number of years, works in the area of violence against women. And as you may know, violence against women work for a long time, especially in the human rights space, was really about equal protection. Does the government respond to violence against women when it happens and the way it responds to violence more generally? And that was because it was the only way we as women's rights activists could get the human rights system to take us seriously, is saying, you're not giving us the same justice that you're giving everybody else. But that's a pretty inadequate response to violence against women if you think about it, particularly violence against women in the family, which is so prevalent in so many societies. Wouldn't it be better if it just didn't happen in the first place? So that's what this organization, SEDAVIP, that we fund in Uganda started asking itself. How can we actually create a model that is about prevention, not about response? And they started thinking about gender dynamics and what is the role of patriarchy in any relationship between a man and a woman in Uganda? And they thought, okay, let's look at ways we shift our culture, not just ways we utilize our justice system. So they started, sewing circles with women, and they did radio soap operas that had messaging about violence against women. They went to tuk-tuk stands and talked to taxi drivers about, what do you think about this? And what about your mother? And what about your sister? And they started, and they created police officers in local police stations to deal exclusively with familial violence. And then they partnered with the London School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene to do a longitudinal study over 10 years to see what difference they made. And what they found is that in the communities that had experienced the work of this organization, it's called the SASA model, the incidence of violence against women in the family was 52% less than it was in the control communities. So, and that organization now has partnered with groups in over 20 countries with over over 60 different organizations to take the things that they've learned and turn it into a genuine effort to stop violence against women. Not to respond to it, but to stop it. And that's the kind of risk-taking. Invest in an organization that has enormous potential to then not only show you the difference they can make, but then take that to scale by working with other organizations in other countries. So that's the kind of thing that gets me excited.
So fabulous. Build and defend local organizations. Think about culture change and prevention and new paradigms. The conundrum we've touched on tackling authoritarianism and where you have very small spaces and how you find those spaces. I want to come to another area which I think is different than when we started our human rights work, which is information architecture, social media. Because when I started my human rights work, it was, you need a free press. We want radio stations, newspapers, and free television channels. And we want them to be able to report freely without any risk of censorship about democracy, the questions of the day, and also about human rights violations when they occur. And, you know, free media is our goal. Turns out free media is a more complicated thing in 2022 when platforms encourage genocide, stoke authoritarian narratives about the past, have Russian soldiers arriving in Ukraine not knowing why they're there and thinking that they'll be welcomed with garlands, and in fact they're not. And I think that the big internet giants are grappling with this. And I suspect that we in the human rights movement, to put it generously, haven't always been coherent and thought about this. And I wonder whether this is an area where you think there is a space for some more imaginative giving and how one would architect around that giving.
Yeah, I mean, there's always space for more imagination, right? This is a huge issue in the human rights context. One, because a part of the, I mean, talking about media, I'm also thinking just about technology and the kind of surveillance that technology has made possible and how much more difficult and high risk that has made human rights work for many of the organizations we support. I also know that both from a media perspective and from a technology perspective, it's made things possible in a positive way for human rights activists. They can organize and communicate their messages, obviously, in ways they didn't used to be able to, and sometimes and oftentimes circumnavigate the kinds of blocks that states put up to continue to utilize technology to get their messages and information out. So it's a constant cat and mouse game between governments and organizations in the technology and surveillance arena. There's also the fact that a lot of organizations have been able to have a bigger impact because of the access to platforms and the ability to communicate directly with their audiences without having to be mediated by any, you know, state or otherwise controlled media. So it's, you know, I think one of the things that we have experimented with, and I know some other donors in this space have too, is supporting independent media to make sure that there is always a narrative out there that is responsible vis-a-vis human rights. And I don't know if others are looking at this from a human rights funding perspective, is what you do about that the toxic narrative that's out there, which ranges from incitement to genocide to the denunciation of human rights activists as fifth columnists or tools of foreign regimes or whatever you want to say that discredits them with a potential constituency they could be building locally, which is their only path to power. And I do think, I mean, you know, the incitement to genocide is not a new thing, right? I mean, I worked on the Rwandan genocide in the early 90s, and that was a big feature of what happened there was the othering of the Tutsis and then the calls to eradicate them. So the problem is that the reach is infinitely greater than it was in those days. I mean, it was bad enough in those days. It's even worse now. And the question is, what do you do about it? And I don't know that there's a way to close it down. And I don't know that there's a way that funding, I don't know there's a role for funding there. But what funding can do is support those independent media voices, not only to get their narrative out there, but to be reliably there and to figure out ways to creatively support them when they come under fire. Because of course they do. I mean, the only two independent media outlets that still existed in Moscow 2 weeks ago no longer exist. And so what is a way to support that kind of voice setting up someplace else and being able to, you know, figure out a way to communicate with people in the country, because there are so many channels to do that, that if they might just be able to do it. And, you know, there are human rights organizations, including international organizations, that have made this their area of specialty. They can help local organizations figure out a way to communicate externally, regardless of what blockages the governments lay down. And I think that may be our best, I mean, it sounds a little bit like your nostalgia for the days of the free press, but that may really be the most important thing we can do, is make sure that that narrative is always there and that we're doing our best to push it out and to scale in a way that is a countering narrative to the more toxic ones.
Another thorny question, refugees. I asked you this question because not only are we seeing the most accelerated exodus of refugees in the heart of Europe than we've seen since World War II, but climate is going to produce a wave of refugees that make this seem tepid if any of the projections are even vaguely on track. And it seems to me, from a human rights perspective, this is a uniquely vulnerable group. They're transient. They're not well organized. You can't build organization around a group of people who are fragmented and arriving in different countries in different ways. And therefore, one lapses back onto thinking about the problem as a humanitarian problem, which is a problem about giving people food and comfort and sacks of food, and not necessarily as a kind of human rights question or a reintegration or a settlement question, etc. And it may be one of those areas where a good amount of investment and thinking and infrastructure building may be warranted and called for. But since you think about this often, you discuss.
All right. Well, the first thing I would say is that it's not necessarily accurate to say that you can't fund organizations that support and deal with the human rights consequences of a migrant's journey. We actually fund organizations in countries of origin, countries of transit, and countries of destination, and we fund them to collaborate with each other. And so what that means is that, you know, there might be an organization in Morocco, in fact there is, that is known as a resource for sub-Saharan African migrants who are trying to make their way to Europe. And they are looking at how do they get treated when they're in Morocco. Are their rights being violated? And what happens if they get stuck in Morocco or decide to stay there? And so that community, which has been a resource for people, sure, for humanitarian purposes to some extent, but the resources that it requires to meet the humanitarian needs of migrant populations or refugee populations is huge. So oftentimes what these organizations are doing is looking at ways to protect the rights of those individuals and populations, and also to make sure they gain access to the resources that are made available by international or governmental agencies. So you have it, you can actually provide support for that journey, but there's a bigger question here, which is how do you deal with the underlying issues and recognize that refugees, climate refugees, they're not going away. You know, when during the Trump administration in the United States, when there was talk of the migrant crisis at the southern border, what people didn't talk about was the fact that climate change was making it impossible, for example, coffee farmers in the hills in the mountains of Honduras to make a living anymore. They were starving, and they were going the only place they knew how to go because there was nothing happening in their country. There was no alternative. There's no development. There's no infrastructure. And part because it's an incredibly corrupt government, in relationship with the United States, which has effectively protected it from its corruption and the consequences thereof. So these are not Honduran problems. These are not, you know, Chadian problems. These are problems for the global community. And if we don't begin to address them, if I lived in a place where my children were starving because of the consequences of climate change, I would move too. And so I think that, you know, there is a need at the global level for the kind of advocacy that will get governments to think about these problems, not just as, you know, protect our borders problems, which is a very significant challenge, not to be underestimated. But at the same time, I think it's really important to think about ways we can support the development of those support frameworks so that migrants and refugees aren't left totally abandoned. I mean, when we started funding this work in Morocco, the Moroccan police were known for rounding up refugees and migrants and leaving them in the desert on the other side of the Algerian border with no money, no food, and no water. Now, there's a regularization policy in Morocco that allows migrants and refugees to obtain status and be able to stay in the country, and even in some cases to work and support their families, which is progress. So it is possible to make change. I think one of the things, Paul, with every question you've asked is that the entry point to the question is a huge, seemingly insurmountable global problem. And I think part of the moral of the story that I'm trying to tell is that those problems don't only get fixed with one grand solution. They get fixed with many smaller solutions that lead to the kinds of change that create a different frame of reference.
That is a remarkable note in which to end, a masterclass both in human rights and in philanthropy and in organization building. And the Fund for Global Human Rights has been at the forefront of this for an enormously long time. And for that, I think advocates and human rights activists around the world should be enormously grateful. And we're enormously grateful for your insights. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about Regan and her work, please go to the Fund for Global Human Rights website. And for more information about the Conduits and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.